Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, allies, and students scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording in the early hours of dawn on the 10th of February, 2013. It's a Sunday morning, the last day of the Matangi shift of 2013. And the title of this briefing, number 47, is The Flash of Matangi's Blade. The actual moment of this recording is what is called the dark of the moon, traditionally. The dark of the moon is the last 2 days of any lunar cycle when the moon is invisible due to its proximity to the sun. At that moment, it's possible, under the right conditions of observation, to sometimes see the super thin crescent of the moon in the eastern sky just before the sun rises. That is also called the balsamic moon, with a reference to balsam or nectar. And that reference is an archaic and esoteric clue of profound significance. What you can experience in the dark of the moon is the ultimate distillation of Dakini wisdom that comes subliminally, that comes to you in the subliminal frequencies of your own mind. And the particular advantage of transceiving Dakini instruction at these moments is due to the intensity of the physical incorporation of that instruction. As I explained in one of the other briefings I did earlier this evening, Dakini wisdom, which is sometimes called the elixir of the seminal heart, is actually a dew-like distillation in the atmosphere. And figuratively speaking, the sunrise crescent is like a chalice that holds this Dakini elixir of the seminal heart wisdom of the planetary goddess, the wisdom goddess Sophia. And there is an experience actually of putting your lips to the cup, as it were, to the chalice of the sunrise crescent, and drinking this wisdom. That's a practice in Gaian echo sorcery. So being in the midst of that practice this morning, and having been under intense instruction with Matangi now for the last 27 days, I can offer this single line of Dakini instruction from Matangi. Clear detection of the presence of the supernatural is the key to human sanity. This instruction is extremely helpful at this particular moment in the GNE, because this is the moment when we begin to undertake intensively the formulation of strategies of the Kalika War Party. There are various ways to participate in the correction of the Divine Sophia. Various ways, And I'm sure you members of the crew and you practitioners of planetary tantra can find your own ways and can invent them within the parameters of the experiment and following the simple framework of planetary tantra. I'm sure that you respect the wisdom teachings of the Mother Goddess, the Mother Earth Goddess, that you respect them enough to stay within those guidelines and not to invent in a reckless or narcissistic fashion. That, after all, is the discipline. But among the practices, central among the practices and foremost, is the engagement in psychic and psychological war with the enemies of the planet. That is our part. That is the part that some self-selected human animals can play in the correction of the divine Sophia. Clear detection of the presence of the supernatural is the key to human sanity. Clear detection means that you don't just speculate about the supernatural, that you don't make wild and reckless claims about luciferic powers or the satanic cabal that's ruling the earth, that you don't make wild comments and groundless and unverifiable claims about the supernatural. Clear detection means that you know something that is voracious and impeccable, that you hold a steady, voracious, and impeccable view of the presence of the supernatural in this world and in the human mind, which of course includes your own mind. That act of detection is a strategic act in Kalika war strategy. It is, I would say, that act of clear detection is the strategic act that every single human animal needs to make on their own in order to be positioned in this engagement. The engagement now begins. To conduct psychological and psychic warfare against the enemies of the planet who use that kind of warfare on the human species. This is what I mean by the engagement. Now, I'd like to throw in something here, which I don't usually do, but it's a reference to a one-time associate of mine who's been on my mind off and on lately, and that's Jay Widener, who did the DVD on Sophia Returning, the Dawn of Planetary Tantra. And I've spoken of this event and of my interaction with Jay in Amsterdam in 2008 on a couple of previous occasions. It so happens that this evening, at some point, I tuned in to some parts of an interview Jay did with Vinnie Eastwood. And I must say, I felt sad listening to him. I don't know what's happened to Jay recently, but he sounds like he's either sold out or been scared off or both. In any case, I'd like to take a couple of comments that he made as context to make a couple of comments of my own. I figure that's fair play. Everyone who puts themselves out into the media the way that Jay does and the way that I do is open to that kind of play. I don't have a criticism to make of Jay Widener's comments, but I'd like to use them to present my own comments relative to the same subject matter. At one point, Jay says that the trouble with things on this planet and with the machinations of the predators and psychopaths and the orchestrations of social evil that we see everywhere are unfolding as if there was some kind of invisible devil operating. He uses that term invisible devil in reference to the fact that although the enemies of humanity can be named, you know, the Jesuits, the Illuminati, the Freemasons, and so forth and so on, it's terribly difficult to actually pin down the source of those various agents of social evil, who may be considered merely as proxies serving an ultimate source. And Jay points out, quite correctly, and I agree, that it is difficult to identify that ultimate source. He also says to identify the force, that is to say, the operative force and the executive force behind the various agents of evil on this planet. But what Jay says is that we can't identify it, or we haven't yet been able to do so. Well, I disagree. We can identify it, and to do so is absolutely necessary in keeping with the instruction of Matangi that I just cited. Clear detection of the presence of the supernatural is the key to human sanity. That is to say, the presence of the supernatural in the world, in the realm of human affairs, and in the human mind, in the collective mind of the human species. Those of you who follow my talks will know that for some time now, not too long, the identification of the force and source, the executive force and source of this evil can be seen in the figure of Mephisto. And I've stated that Mephisto, the trickster, who is the prince of lies, is actually not only a complex or archetype in the human mind operating through the imagination and emotions and thoughts of all human animals, but is also a material archetype, a tulpa. This figure, Mephisto, is the source behind the machinations of social evil, and it is not a human entity, but it is a human-generated entity. Now, that's an answer, that's a response to the question Jay Widener raises. Quite rightly, he asserts challenge to truth seekers on this planet, to all those who love life and would protect life, and that is to correctly identify the source that is directing and driving the machinations of evil on Earth. Now, I don't know what Jay Widener would say about my claims regarding this entity, Mephisto. I don't know if Jay listens to my talks. I rather think he doesn't. Probably just doesn't have the time or interest. But if he did, and if he confronted me by saying, well, John, good try, but what if Mephisto is just the invention of your mind? I would respond by saying, that's right, Jay. It is the invention of my mind. And it's the invention of your mind, too. And it's the invention of all the minds of human animals. It is the invention of the imagination of the human species itself. But that invention is a self-standing and autonomous power. And I think that Jay knows enough about archetypal psychology as derived from C.G. Jung, etc., to concur with me that these so-called archetypes of the collective unconscious do operate by an autonomous power upon the human animal, even though they are only productions of the mind of the human animal. That is the nature of these archetypes, and that is also, obviously, testimony to the power of human imagination. So as I've said before, you better use your imagination and use it wisely and correctly, or someone else will use it, or it will use itself against you. This is the challenge of our species based on the way that we have been designed by the Aeon Sophia. So, second comment I want to make, again referring to this rather sad and depressing interview, concerns the archons. And of course, Jay has now the habit of citing the archons without reference to me or without reference to my particular work in recovering the Nag Hammadi material from the viewpoint of the people who wrote it and not from the viewpoint of the people who tried to destroy it. Jay makes a mistake which other people make who now cite the archon, the Gnostic profile of the archons. Not that he doesn't credit me, because I'm not looking for credit, but that he doesn't point out that the archons are a byproduct of the Aeon Sophia. They are an inadvertent anomaly or accident produced by her plunge from the pleuromic core. Nor does he point out the connection between the intrusion of the archons into the human species and the cult of the Zadikim. So the archon profile is a crucial piece of intel for anyone living on the earth today who wants to fight for life and sanity and beauty and freedom and happiness on this planet. But that intel needs to be handled responsibly. And Jay Widener and a number of other people who cite the archon profile do not handle it in a responsible way. That is shown by the elimination or omission of the origin of the archons, as well as of the discrete and particular and singular connection of the archons to the Zadikim ideology of the ancient Hebrews, which is the root of global terrorism, as I have explained in Not in His Image. Clear enough? Now, I don't want to persist in this briefing, nor in any other talk I do, with what appears to be an exercise in bashing Jay Widener. Truth be told, I don't get any pleasure out of bashing Jay Widener. In fact, I feel sad from what appears to have happened to his mind recently. But as he often refers to the Archon thesis, but does so in an irresponsible manner, I would like to use him as an example to show you how it goes badly wrong when this intel is handled in a careless manner. In the course of this interview, which was a pathetic performance, Jay says that the archons are parasites, mind parasites, and he cites the Nag Hammadi material as the source of that description. That is correct, although for some reason he says that the Nag Hammadi material is 2,100 years old, which is not correct. The scholars have established, on the basis of the cartonnage, or the papers found in the bindings of the Nag Hammadi codices, that they were deposited, written down and deposited in the vessels around 350 AD, which makes them about 1,650 years old, not 2,100 years old. That is the actual material, the teaching in those materials. The teachings from the mystery schools, of course, date back millennia previous to that epoch. But when we're talking about textual material, I think it's a good idea to be accurate in citing the age of the textual evidence. And so 2,100 years ago is meaningless and erroneous. Also, I would note, although it did not occur in this interview, but in another one, that Jay made with Jeff Rentz concerning the Sandy Hook event, you hear a statement which I have to say was astounding to me. And Jay said that the Nag Hammadi materials were written by a group called the Essenes, who lived on the Dead Sea in pre-Christian times. Well, it's when I heard him say that in the Jeff Rentz interview that I began to wonder if something didn't happen to his mind. I won't even comment on that statement, and just to say that it is completely wrong, and even people who are superficially acquainted with the Dead Sea Scrolls materials and the so-called Essenes, by comparison to the Nag Hammadi materials and the Gnostics, will recognize that that is completely wrong, and why he would say anything of the deliberately make that statement escapes me. Anyway, to return to the second and final point I want to make here is what Jay says regarding the Archons, namely that they are mind parasites, consistent with the Gnostic profile, but they are parasites keeping us alive. We're the host. They feed off the host, and like a virus or like some kind of insidious cockroach or leech, the Archonic entity has to keep the host alive. Is that what you think, Jay? You think that the Archons are keeping you alive? Speak for yourself. Are they paying your bills? The Archons are certainly mind parasites, but they are most certainly not keeping human animals alive. What keeps you alive is the earth on which you live, okay? And if you don't have clear understanding of that, then you probably have some mental damage, dear listener, okay? And so finally, going along, this is the kind of error, and this is the kind of reckless and ridiculous statements that people make when they don't handle the Archon intel in a responsible manner consistent with the sacred narrative from which it derives. Clear enough? So finally, as if all this were not gruesome enough, Jay comes out and says that he now believes that the psychopaths running around on this planet are actually Archons. So here you have an equation. You take a mind parasite described by the Gnostics, and you a non-human entity, and you equate it with psychopaths who are presumably human animals. Well, I'm here to tell you that the equation, straightforward equation of Archon equals psychopath, or psychopath equals Archon, is erroneous. First of all, Archons are not organic. Psychopaths are organic. They are human animals. Archons are inorganic, cyborg, locus-like entities whose proper habitat is outside the Earth, in the reaches of the solar system, exclusive of the Earth, Moon, and Sun. Archons are extraterrestrials. Psychopaths are terrestrials. Is that clear? Now, you could argue that the psychopathic animals running around this planet are Archon-controlled, that they are ET-controlled, or, as I have said and not in his image, like remote-controlled, because the Archons are extraterrestrials inhabiting a physical zone of interstellar space outside the livable atmosphere of the Earth, although they can make short incursions or forays into the atmosphere. They can't stay here for long because oxygen is lethal to their system, and for other reasons as well. But due to their power of mental intrusion and through the technology in which they excel, which is HAL, or virtual reality simulation, they can intrude into the human mind and actually take over control of human beings from their remote vantage. And so, yes, some psychopathically diseased animals running around on the Earth are Archon-controlled, and hence they act as zombies, as if they were incarnated Archons, but they are not incarnated Archons. You know, the subject of the incarnation of the Archons is a dicey one, and I suppose there's a fair amount of speculation about it. But I hold to the view that the Archons have not been able to produce human simulacra in which they could incarnate themselves. They've not been able to do that. It's their highest wish to do that. It's their next to their highest wish to do that. Their highest wish is to convince us, human animals, that they can do that and indeed have already done that. So the pod people of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and the apocalyptic zombies running around this earth are actually sick and rabid human animals. But they are not incarnated Archons. There are no incarnated Archons, according to my shamanic investigations and my educated conclusion, based strictly on the Gnostic materials and on the sacred narrative of Sophia, is that they have succeeded in producing one human simulacrum, namely Melchizedek. And they have succeeded in taking over the minds and behaviors of a great number of human animals, both psychopaths and non-psychopaths. But they are not incarnating as human beings. And this is a key distinction, and I hold to this distinction rigorously. I would add this warning, however, that they are damn close to achieving that goal. And what allows them to be so close is that the conditions of absolute terror produce a disturbance in the atmosphere of the planet that allows them to congeal, as it were, along the lines of ectoplasmic forms seen in spiritualist seances. So, at moments of tremendous terror on Earth, mass terror, such as the moment of the Kennedy assassination, when the whole world was thrown into mass terror and mass trauma, and the moment of 9/11, and the moment now, more recently, of Sandy Hook, at such moments, the conditions of the atmosphere in which we live become emotionally charged with the energies of terror and fear. And in that saturation, in that emotional saturation, which has a chemical component, The Archons find the optimal condition into which they can ooze down into a kind of ectoplasmic form and materialize in the atmosphere of the Earth, but they can't hold that materialization. The conditions may allow them to border on that materialization, but not to hold it. And so it is their dearest aim to produce an absolute saturation of the atmosphere of fear and terror on this planet. And they pervert and subvert human minds to that end. So with those remarks, come to the halfway point of this briefing, which is entitled The Flash of Matangi's Blade. So, it would be appropriate for me to describe what is the flash of Matangi's blade. What do I mean by that metaphor? Okay? The flash of Matangi's blade is what you see when you reach up with a hand that is free. One hand is holding the knife by the blade, but covered with the sheath. And then you reach up and take the handle and draw it out. And the first thing you see is the flash of Matangi's blade, which is an event that flickers continually in your mind. And the flicker of her blade adds an edge to your perception. Just picture a blade flickering. Just imagine that you're holding up the knife now and you're looking up at the blade and moving it slightly, moving the knife slightly so that the blade, the edge of the blade flickers and light flickers off the sharp edge of the blade. That is the analogy of something that happens in your mind when you take possession of Matangi's knife. How do you know that you have the flash of her blade operating in your mind? It's important to know this strategically, because before you can use her blade, before you can start to use it for its main purpose, which is cutting through the web of deception that originates with the adversary Mephisto, the web of lies, before you use it for that, you need to have the confidence of the flash. And you can actually know that by a simple test. Remember that I said that the sheath of Matangi's knife comes with a question, which is, where is the network and affiliate footage of the motorcade on the day John F. Kennedy was murdered? Now there's a second question. The second question is like a mantra, a formula that you repeat. And as you repeat it, each time you repeat it, it's as if you're moving Matangi's knife in your hand and causing a flash to shine off the blade. So you yourself are actually invoking the flash, as it were, by asking the second question. Now, this second question is really, really brilliant. The second question is a question about the rule of complicity. Now, the rule of complicity is a double entendre. It means, first of all, the rule of complicity. That is to say, rule equals domination. The rule of law, the rule of the Caesars, the rule of the Illuminati. To be under the rule of someone or something means to be dominated or controlled. So, the rule of complicity is about the dominant power of complicity in human affairs. But there is a second meaning as well, and that is the rule of complicity. That is to say, the rule by which it operates. There is a rule by which complicity operates in the human mind. Isn't that amazing? This is Matangi instruction straight out of the sunrise crescent, like a drink of nectar. There is a rule by which complicity in evil operates on this planet. And every single human person, every single human animal is complicit with the evil on this planet unless you see the rule. By default, if you don't see the rule of complicity, then you are a part of the complicity. Remember that I said that Matangi, of all the powers of the Shakti cluster, and among both the liberational and dividiristic Dakinis, is the single one who holds the trick to defeat the trickster. She has the solution to defeat Mephisto, the material archetype at the source of deceit in this world. And the first approach to that solution is to know what is the rule of complicity and not follow the rule. Simple. Can't get more simple than that. So what is this rule? Remember, again, I'm using it, the word rule, in the second. That is to say, by dictionary definition, rule is defined as the usual, customary, or generalized course of action or behavior, or the standard method or procedure for solving a class of problems or for handling a situation. That's the rule you follow. So what is the rule of complicity that you follow without knowing that you do so? This is rather amazing just to stop and consider that such a thing could exist. But I assure you it does, and I assure you that it operates in the collective mind of the human animal in a most direct and concrete manner. And this can be verified by observation once you know what the rule is. Now, consistent with Matangi instruction, it's dawn, by the way. I'm just looking out the doorway here. There's a beautiful, deep, rich band of scarlet on the horizon to the southeast. Consistent with your understanding of Matangi's technique of teaching, let's consider the phenomenon of photography and the use of photography in the past as a way to detect the rule of complicity. Certainly, when photography was invented, one of the principal uses to which it was applied was in forensics and in the pursuit of criminals, you know, what used to be called in the quaint old days of fighting crime. So we've all seen the footage in films or in documentaries of people taking photographs. Now here we're looking at film footage of people taking still photographs, okay? And What does the film footage show, whether it be a documentary or in movies? Well, it shows photographers who belong to a criminal investigation team taking photos of the scene of the crime, taking photos of the victim, photos of, for instance, the evidence, such as a knife on the ground, and photos of the knife wounds of the victim, and things of that sort, blood spatter photos, and so on. So here's an example of using photography to produce an exact replica of the evidence so that the evidence can be preserved and later be studied, and crimes can be solved in this way. In fact, Judy Wood used this technique by examining tens of thousands of photographs of the events of 9/11. She did a forensic investigation, Dr. Judy Wood, using that kind of photographic evidence that has not been faked in any way. So we're assuming here that the photographs taken are genuine and that the evidence is not being faked. Now, obviously, this was a big deal and still used today. One of the most popular genres of American television, which is extremely deceptive, by the way, and part of a, I consider it to be part of a massive mind control program, are CSI and these other series that show criminal investigation teams on the scene of gruesome murders and events. And of course, part of that scenario always includes the team photographer who is snapping photos to later be studied to solve the crime and to be used as evidence in prosecuting the perpetrators, right? Seen it thousands and hundreds of thousands of times. Now, look closely here. Look closely and consider not only the photographs that you are allowed to see, but the photographs that you are not allowed to see. Just direct your mind for a moment back to the 50s and the 60s. If you weren't living during those times, then you might have seen what I'm going to describe now in documentaries about the mafia. Typically, back in those days, there were wars between mafia families. And in those events, some of the mafia dons would be murdered gruesomely in public. So, for example, a mafia don sitting in a barbershop or at an Italian restaurant somewhere in Brooklyn gets taken out, gets shot, assassinated in public. Photographers come along. Of course, the criminal investigation team of the police obviously takes pictures, but you don't see those because they're not to be shown to the public. They're for the purposes of the investigation. But reporters come along and take pictures. And who does not remember the typical picture, usually in black and white, that would have been on the front page of the New York Post or something like that, that shows a mafia boss lying in the street, blood is streaming across the pavement, a coat or a tablecloth is roughly thrown over the figure, but not completely covering it, so leaving some gruesome details to be revealed, and there it is, a still photograph of someone who was actually murdered. And you're allowed to see that. Or you were allowed to see that. The world was allowed to see that for a period of time in the 60s. But do you see anything like that in the newspapers today? Or do you see anything comparable to that on the internet? I'm still talking about still photographs. Let's just concentrate on them. We'll talk about live footage or moving images. When was the last time you saw anything comparable to the still photograph, black and white still photograph, of a mafia, murdered mafia don lying in the street of Brooklyn? Now, while you're holding that question, scan with your mind two other events that have happened more recently. I mean specifically events such as mass murders that have happened, the Aurora killings in the theater in Colorado, killings at a Sikh temple, and of course the Sandy Hook massacre. Do you recall seeing any still photographs of the victims of those killings? When was the last time that you saw in a newspaper, magazine, or on the internet a still photograph of any victim who'd been murdered? Now, it is true, as you all know, I'm sure, that if you know where to look on the internet, you can find photographs of women and children, generally unarmed people, civilians, who have been murdered in the atrocities occurring in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, atrocities committed by the American military executing a proxy war, or by mercenaries who are in the pay of certain evil people. But you really have to go looking for them. It's not allowed to see these images. It's not allowed to show these images. It is not allowed to show these images. Translate that. There is a rule against showing these images. There is a rule against showing still photographs of murdered or tortured, mangled human bodies. Isn't there? And one of the stunning aspects of the Sandy Hook event is the combination of the imagined horror of a schoolroom full of 4 to 8 year old children who have been shot full of holes. The contrast between the imagined horror and the actual photographic evidence showing those children. There's plenty of the imagined horror in every single mind of every single human animal who hears about the event. But there is a complete and total lack of photographic evidence. Were the parents allowed to see photographic evidence of their murdered children? Well, one rumor that you hear on the internet is that they were not allowed, the authorities did not allow them to actually see the bodies of their children, but did present them with photographs. Does that strike you as extremely odd and perhaps even perverse? I don't know if that's true or not, but if it is true that the authorities did not permit those parents to see the murdered bodies of their own children, then something is terribly, terribly wrong. Just on that level of events, what authority in the world could forbid a parent to see that if a parent wished to see that? And what parent wouldn't wish to see it? So there's something terribly wrong with the Sandy Hook story there, and that requires some close reflection. But let's bring it back to the question of the photographic evidence. Recall what I said about the unique nature of the Sandy Hook PSYOP. Namely, that in this event, the authorities, whoever they are, whoever has the authority to impose such a rule, have forbidden any of the photographic evidence of the murder of these children to be shown to the world. But I propose to you that they are not merely withholding photographic evidence of what happened. They are withholding photographic evidence of what didn't happen. Or, to put it another way, they are withholding evidence that doesn't exist. And that is what is so powerful about this PSYOP. You see, if I committed a crime and I didn't want you to know anything about how I did it or that I was the perpetrator of the crime, and there existed photographic, telltale photographic evidence of the crime, well, I would certainly do my best to get my dirty hands on that evidence and keep you from seeing it. Then there would be a struggle, a conflict, a challenge. The challenge would be for you, who wish to understand the truth of the crime, to get your hands on the evidence that is being withheld from you. And that could be difficult, but it's a challenge worth undertaking, because if the evidence exists and you can get your hands on it, then you know the truth about the crime. But you can't get your hands on evidence that doesn't exist. But if I lead you to think that I am withholding that evidence from you, it makes you even crazier than you would be if I withhold evidence that does exist, doesn't it? And that is how the PSYOP works. The PSYOP has been constructed with diabolical cleverness to penetrate into layers of the human mind that are even deeper than those affected by the 9/11 event. And part of this Sandy Hook PSYOP, as I have maintained before, is to test the strength and determination of the minds of truth seekers. It's a test to see how well the fix is holding up. And it's a test that I expect to be a preliminary move to the next major event, which will involve a combination of psychological warfare and massive mayhem and murder. I'm not predicting that it will happen, and I'm not even certain that it will happen. I don't know if they'll pull it off or not, but it's my educated guess that they would dearly like to pull it off, and that they, the perpetrators, are moving in that direction. So, what is the rule of complicity? Well, it's a rule that you can detect existentially in the behavior of the media, in the behavior of those people in our world who assume the role of reporting to the world events that have happened. When you look at Sandy Hook, you find this rule rubbed in your face, as it were. And it's really a good thing that this happens, because by having the rule rubbed in your face, you have the opportunity to stop and apply the Matangi eye and actually detect the rule, which goes like this. There is an unwritten rule observed by people in the media not to show accurate non-faked photographs of murdered people or victims of massacres. And everyone in the media, whether it be on the national level of the big networks or on the local level, follows this rule. Now, it's true there may be some exceptions to this rule. For instance, I don't know, if you live in Oakland, maybe the local paper in Oakland, whatever it is, would contain photographs of some gangland killing or some people lying in a parking lot who had been murdered. There might be cases when these sensational photographs are released, and when they appear in newspapers or perhaps even in magazines. And that would occur, obviously, for the purpose of selling newspapers and magazines. So you could say that some margin in the application of the rule is allowed in order to sell newspapers and magazines, but absolutely no margin is given to present to the world at large vivid, undoctored photographic evidence of murder and massacre. That is the rule. And just consider how many people follow that rule. And ask yourself, well, why? Why do they follow that rule? What compels them to? Are they under some kind of coercion? Are they under a threat to follow that rule? Not to show still life photographs of murdered and mutilated people. Who introduced this rule? Is it an FCC regulation? Who introduced the FCC regulation? And how do they enforce it? And considering the countless numbers of events that occur, including these occasional, more and more frequent, occasional mass murders, isn't it clear that the rule is rigorously applied in these cases? Assuming that a certain number of people were killed in the Aurora shooting in Colorado. Have you ever seen any photographs? No, you haven't seen photographs. But in that instance, most people would say people were really murdered in that theater. The police photographers and forensic investigation team took photographs, but none of those photographs were shown to the public following the rule. And if anyone else took photographs, they were not shown to the public either. They were not allowed to be shown consistent with the rule. But where does this rule come from? And how can it be so consistently and widely enforced? Now, while you're considering that question, I need to bring in one other factor to make this picture complete and take us to the end of this briefing with a clear understanding of the flash of Matangi's blade. I ask you to hold in your mind clearly the distinction between still photography and moving pictures, film footage, still photography and film footage. Now, take the case of the mass killing in the theater in Aurora, Colorado. Considering that there was no CC camera running in the theater filming the people in the audience who were watching the movie, there is no running footage of the people being massacred. So obviously that is the case of most crimes, isn't it? Most crimes, and if a murder takes place down the block, you're not going to have the murderer on film because the murderer doesn't want to be filmed and acts in such a way, if they pay attention, if someone's standing there with a cell phone filming them while they're committing them to murder, they'd be obliged to destroy that evidence, if not murder the person filming them. So for the purposes of simplicity and getting away with it, murderers do not let themselves be filmed. So there is a conspicuous lack of live footage of murders and crimes being committed, except, of course, for CC footage. So you don't see films of actual murders, do you? And you don't see, by the explanation I've just given, obviously not. And you don't see films of, you don't see still photographs of the effects of actual murders and massacres, do you? But consider what you do see. Consider what you are allowed to see by contrast to the rule that does not allow you to see things. Consider what every human animal sees on this planet from a very, very early age And that is to say, hours and hours and hours and hours, extending to months and years, of simulated massacres and simulated murders. I don't know what the statistics are, we've all heard them, but how many simulated murders, including gruesome tortures and dismemberments with chainsaws and things like that, has a child, an American kid of the age of 10, seen? Not only the films on television and in the theaters depicting simulated murders, but look at what's happening in the video galleries. Look at the video games, which are based on murder, in which the young child playing a game is in a virtual reality situation committing murder. So I think you'd have to admit that in the culture that we live in today, there is enormous saturation, enormous and dense saturation of images of simulated violence, at the same time that there is rigorous application of the rule that you are not allowed to see even a still photograph of an actual victim of actual violence. Now, why is that? Who set up that rule? Who decided that it would be allowable in society to depict simulations of murder, of torture, of horrific acts, of sadism, and to disseminate these widely through the media, through films, and through television, and through video games? Who decided that all that is allowable, but it is not allowable to show an actual photograph of a human person who has been murdered or tortured? Who made up that rule, and how is it enforced? How is it even possible to enforce such a rule? Well, here we go. Here is the moment when you catch the flash on the edge of Mutangi's blade, and you realize the manifest absurdity of this situation, but also how inexplicable it is. And the inexplicability of it is what you want to keep focused in your mind. Not only is it inexplicable that there is an unwritten rule that allows simulated violence and sadism and torture to be massively displayed and disseminated across the planet, but going along with it, there is a rule that disallows any display of an actual, accurate, still photograph of a murdered or tortured human animal. Because that would be offensive. Have you heard that line before? That would be offensive. It would be so offensive to you tender-hearted people in the world out there, and so offensive and demonstrating lack of compassion for the parents of those children murdered at Sandy Hook, if the public were allowed to see true and undoctored, unfaked photographs of those murdered children. That would be so offensive, wouldn't it? But I put it to you that the opposite is the truth. After all, if there were public media presenting photographs of the massacred children of Sandy Hook, you don't have to look at them if you don't want to. They're just there to be seen, but no one is required or forced to look at them. So those who would be offended by seeing those photographs have no excuse because they would only be offended if they looked at them, and no one's forcing them to look at them. The real offense here is not an offense against sensibility or an offense or crime against sympathy with the victims and their parents. The real offense is perpetrated upon your mind and your perception by the rule that denies you the option to see those photographs, to see the photographic evidence of what has actually been done to human beings by other human beings. I said years ago in Santa Fe, when I was sitting in a cafe having a conversation with someone, and I can't remember the context or what brought it up, I said, you know, we hear so much about the effects of violence in films and on television and in video games, the effects of violence upon our society, and everyone speculates how much that display of violence is making our culture violent and teaching young people to be violent, or giving them the license to be violent, or inspiring or encouraging them to be violent from an early age. But that argument is specious, because in fact, young people are not seeing true violence. They are seeing simulated violence. And my argument in the conversation of that time was like this. It was in the form of a question. Well, I wonder what would happen if young people and the whole world at large were exposed to photographs and footage of real violence. For instance, a prison riot or an actual war scene where people are murdered and blown apart, or the aftermath of that, or the aftermath of a crime scene, or even real photography taken at the scene of a gruesome automobile pileup with body parts splattered around and people gagging on their own blood sitting in the front seat. Would you like to see a film of that? I would. I'd like to see lots of films of that made available to the public. And I would like to see what effect that has on the violence in our world. Do you think that is going to inspire children to be violent? I'd like to know. Of course, maybe you would like to know as well, but we can't know, can we? Because the rule says that that is not allowed. And where in the fuck does this rule come from? As you consider that question, it is exactly as if you have Matangi's knife in your hand and you are twisting your wrist slightly backward and forward and watching the light flash on that blade. Keep asking that question. Who made up this rule, and where does it come from? Because that rule is the rule of complicity. It is a demonstration of a deep and far-reaching act of complicity. You cannot discern who invented that rule. You cannot establish how that rule is enforced, yet you must admit that it is enforced. It is enforced. What enforces that rule is the complicity of the human mind in the effects of a supernatural agency in your mind. So in concluding this briefing, let me make one extremely difficult but highly liberating observation. This is not a claim John Lash is making. This is not a pet theory. It's not an interpretation. It's an observation I make, offer to you as an observation to consider if you would make it your own observation and verify it on your own terms. This is my observation. You can go nuts. You can waste your entire life and drive your mind to rack and ruin, trying to understand how a 9/11 event or a Sandy Hook event could have been accomplished, considering the degree of complicity required to pull off such an event. The degree of complicity required to execute the 9/11 event and to plan and execute the Sandy Hook event boggles the mind. And no matter how much you think about it and how much you ponder it, you cannot arrive at a rational explanation of how such complicity could be achieved. Certainly people could be paid to do this who have no conscience. Certainly people could be paid to act and play act and fake. Certainly people could be tricked into participating through one way or another. Certainly people could be involved in such orchestrations by the process of compartmentalization. They contribute a part to the event without knowing what is the whole event or what its objective or purpose is. Consider all those things. Consider all the people who could then be made accessories in those ways and in other ways, and you still cannot arrive at the depth of complicity that is required for these events to happen in our world. And why not? Because the key to the complicity, the ultimate key to that complicity that makes it all work as a diabolical scheme of orchestration, is a supernatural factor. There is a supernatural factor operating in our world. It is the supernatural factor that generates and imposes the rule of complicity. And the instruction of Matongi warns that human animals can never detect the ultimate operations of evil in their world without incorporating a supernatural factor in the equation. That is precisely where the supernatural factor comes in. And the challenge of understanding this teaching is to identify and detect the supernatural presence exactly where it is, according to exactly how it operates, and not to speculate and not to invent and not to have merely a wild, reckless, and undisciplined apprehension of the supernatural. It is through the complicity that produces evil that you arrive at a clear detection of the supernatural. And everything that is supposed to be working in these orchestrations of evil, demonic powers, diabolical forces, Satanists, Luciferians, all of these are products of the principal force, that is to say, of the trickster. They are simply magical tricks produced out of the trickster's hat, produced out of the trickster's cape. And so, not to be distracted or misled by the magical tricks, you have to look at the trickster itself. You have to focus on that single supernatural entity, which is the source of all these evil and diabolical operations that drive and compel human animals into sadistic and self-destructive behaviors. That is the play of Mephistopheles operating inside a web of lies. The play of Mephistopheles and the pleasure of the Archons, if indeed they can be considered to experience pleasure, is that rampage of sadistic and insane destruction. And this is real. This is real. It is the real source of the nightmare of history. You can bet that the Aeon Sophia is looking at that source right where it is. And Mtongi directs you to look in the same way that she looks and in the same place, and to detect this adversarial power of the supernatural as it works in the human mind, to detect it clearly and unequivocally. So the Sandy Hook Massacre is a great lesson in that detection. And there are other lessons to come following the primary instruction of Mtongi, which is clear detection of the presence of the supernatural is the key to human sanity.